Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Infinite Worlds podcast. I'm your host, Winston Ward, publisher of Infinite Worlds magazine. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Nick the Tooth.
Dude, long time, no talk, but here we are again.
Seriously. It's been like, what, more than a month, maybe 5 weeks since we got a chance to record last. And during that time, you moved from staying in England to moving to Italy, isn't that right?
Yeah, I'm in Sicily.
You're now a full-time Sicilian.
Full freaking time living on the other side of the world, man.
Do you have like a residence documents and all that kind of stuff? Like, are you like an official resident?
Dude, it has been the craziest. I can't even tell you what it's been like. I finally have a place. But for the past month, I have dealt with, I'm going to tell you what, I never appreciated, wasn't it Terry Gilliam who did the movie Brazil?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, dude, I remember watching that and being like, I don't really get that. Oh, I get it now. I get it now.
Okay, you got to explain.
Oh my God, dude. Okay. So I'm getting my citizenship here, right? So that was kind of the goal here, to come here, get my Italian citizenship, because my grandfather was born in Italy. And so I started researching it. And after my daughter moved to London, I was like, well, I would like to be closer to her. It'd be cool to leave the United States, which, given today's topic of the episode, is actually a good thing, right?
Yeah,
so anyway, I started researching it and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm entitled to get citizenship in Italy because my grandfather was born there. And so it's kind of this thing. So I started doing all the legal research, and my buddy, who's a UFC fighter, Chito Vera, he actually went through the process also because he had a relative that was Italian. And so
is he there as well now?
No. But he has an Italian passport.
Okay.
And so because of that, I was like, well, I'm going to see if I can get mine. And it turned out I also, through a series of when people were born and all this, I'm entitled to get it. And so I started putting together all these documents dating back to 1914. And I've been doing that for two years, dude, from National Archives. I had to get things. Every birth certificate, every death certificate, every marriage certificate, like in my lineage, and I had to get them, they had to be certified. And then I had to get that, go through a process called an apostille, which means I had to take those to, like, I had to get his naturalization records and send them to, the Secretary of State, the State Department in Washington, D.C. And I had to have every single Secretary of State also do that. So these documents had to be like triple. Then I had to get to Italy and I had to get them translated. And then I had to go before a court and get them sworn so that they were like official, and like triple, quadruple official. Yeah, no, but then check this out. That's when it really started, because I was like, okay, I don't have any transportation here. I need to buy a motorcycle, right? I need to do something. And so I went to this department. Everyone, like when I went to buy it, I was like, here's the money. I just want it. They're like, we can't sell you a motorcycle. You need to have X, Y, and Z. And the first thing you need is what's called a codus fiscale. And it's kind of like a number that allows you to, like a social security number, something like that. Similar to that, right? So I went there and you brought my passport and everything. And I have a buddy that's translating. And the first person I sat down with, you know, after taking a number and waiting hours, and getting a number, and then we couldn't come back for like 10 days. Then we came back. Yeah. And then we waited hours. And then I went and sat and talked to someone just like in that movie, Brazil. And they sat there and they're like, you can't get a codus fiscale. You're American. You're not allowed to get one. And I'm like, whoa. I'm like, I'm here applying as an Italian citizen. I can't apply as an Italian citizen unless you give me this number. and I'm allowed to apply. And not only that, Americans are allowed to buy property in Italy. They need this number. Dude, 30 minutes later of arguing, my buddy arguing for me, translating all this. Finally, this guy called his supervisor. She came over 40 minutes later of arguing, her telling us, no, I can't get it and all this. We're an hour into this argument, right? Then she calls her supervisor. He comes over and goes, oh, yeah, just give it to him. He's American. That was it. And so I got this one number, but check it out. Every single thing that I have tried to do, almost to the point of just even buying groceries, is like that here. Everybody tells you no. The first thing they tell you out of your mouth is no. No, can't do that. No, sorry, can't do that.
Dude, it's bureaucracy life going on for you there.
Dude, it's so crazy. Finally, so I went into the, after, you know, I'm a lawyer. I did all this research. Then I have a lawyer here, an immigration lawyer that I consulted with, and he looked at all my documents, said, yeah, you're fine. I went into what's called the Comuna. After getting all these things, right? And all these documents and the Codis Fiscali and, oh, dude, I can't even tell you the things that I have had to do. And I'm doing every day this madness of jumping through hoops. And I finally went into the Comuna and the woman who finally agreed to see me. She looks at all my documents. She goes, no, there's a problem here. You're not going to be able to get citizenship.
Oh, what was the problem?
That's what I said. What is the problem? And so my buddy starts arguing with her. And then she's like, well, this is this. I told her, I was like, I was so pissed off. I was like, I'm a lawyer, blah, 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 da, da, da. My buddy's translating. You tell me right now what the problem is. And she couldn't tell me, right? And then I was like, she's like, what? I'm going to contact an agency. I said, ask her what agency right now she's going to contact. And she couldn't answer, right?
Oh, so, man. They're just like trying to stonewall you.
Totally. Winston, every step of every aspect. So, dude, check this out. So then I left this little comuna. It's in a small village that my grandfather was born in. Okay. And my family has lived here for centuries. And so I get off of there and I'm so pissed off. I've been texting my aunt, my great aunt, and she lives here. She's not my great aunt. She's my aunt. And so I texted her and we DM each other all the time. And I told her what happened. Dude, she called the Comuna and was like, that's my nephew. He's not a tourist, blah, 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 blah. And then she's like, oh, no, there's no problems. And then yesterday, my aunt, who I'd never met in person, I finally met my aunt, you know, and it was real emotional. It was awesome. And then she brought me hand by my hand into the Comuna and straightened everyone out. And they're like, no, there's no more problems. There's no problem.
It's like one of those real closed societies. They've just got to have a local vouch for you.
Totally. You know what, Winston?
Be honest with you, though, if I'm a small town in some other country and I have Americans trying to move to my small town, I am probably going to you know what I mean? I'm probably going to be like, whoa, about that too, because we are giving ourselves one shitty reputation right now.
And that is exactly what happened, because you have all these Americans here trying to get their citizenship and they're becoming very resentful of it. And they're like, absolutely not. And so it wasn't until she came in and said, listen, our family's been here for centuries. He's here. He's living here now. This is going to happen. So then that was the only way to, oh, but it's Winston. It's been so crazy. And dude, let me tell you about Palermo. So this is the city. Palermo is, if I could describe it to you, bro, it is Gotham. I'm living in fucking Gotham. It is insane. And by that, I mean, it is one of the coolest cities, like ancient architecture.
I love it.
It's also gritty. And so there are cars. So I'm driving a motorcycle everywhere. And it is the only rule of the road is go. Just go. people drive on the wrong side of the road. Half the people are on motorcycles, scooters. There's old ladies on scooters. People are driving, talking on their phones, driving a motorcycle. I've never seen anything like it. Weaving in and out and in and out. It's like a hive mind of driving. Dude, it is the most chaotic yet synchronized thing I've ever experienced in my life. And you just have to go.
You better be careful on that motorcycle though, bud.
Oh, it's insane. It's insane. It's terrifying. So what happens, like, the scariest thing is that cars and all are weaving in and out. So the only way to stay safe is to weave right through the cars and go as fast as you can and get way ahead of them. I'm not joking. You get way ahead of the cars and get to the red light. Or if you come to a red light and all the cars are stopped, you better get your ass through the middle
to the
of
front.
All the cars to the to the front of the red light. And when that light turns green, you better gun it and get to the next red light and stay ahead of the cars.
Well, you know, I know you could take care of yourself, obviously, but it just kind of gives me a mental image of you weaving in through like crazy traffic in a foreign country and gunning it at red lights.
So, that's, you know, me. That's exactly what it is.
Living the wildlife over there for sure.
Oh, I know. And so check it out. One final thing is I am living in the chambers of an ancient palace that was built in 1100.
What?
Yes.
Like a nearly 1,000-year-old building?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm living beneath a cathedral that was part of a castle.
Do you see any ghosts?
Dude, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to look out as I'm talking to you. I'm going to look out my balcony, bro, and I'm looking at the castle.
That is awesome. That is awesome.
I know. I'm looking at the castle, bro.
When I look out my window here at my loft in Denver, I see a bunch of scaffolding because they're like redoing the edifice. My building's like 100 and something years old, and they're like redoing the edifice of it right now, which is one of the reasons we kept having to reschedule. We were supposed to record this before, but we kept having to record because every time we sat down, the maintenance crew is like right outside of my window joking with each other and banging, like chiseling and hammering and shit. So it's been an adventure here too, but not like your adventure, that's for sure.
Well, the good thing now though is that, you know, to wrap this up, is that now for the first time in 2 years, 2.5 years, I have my own place again, like I did
nice.
At the start of the podcast. And so now I've got Wi-Fi, I'm situated, I'm gonna be here for a couple years.
You got a spot.
I got a spot, and I'm so happy to not be a nomad again. You know, I needed to get over that. It was awesome, but I need a little more stability. So I'm stable in Gotham now.
And it sounds like you got a nice internet connection going on too. Which is great.
And dude, let me tell you something. Again, the bureaucracy of just getting that was insane.
I believe it.
But I have it. And I'm stoked. So anyways, today's episode, we are talking about the dystopia that has, you know, befallen America. And that was predicted back in the 80s by one of our favorite authors, definitely one of mine, Margaret Atwood, in The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, Handmaid's Tale, like as soon as the SCOTUS leak happened, both sides of the argument were up in arms about it. And I texted you like that day and was like, dude, we've got to do Handmaid's Tale episode. We've been wanting to anyway. We've talked about it a bunch of times. And, you know, we've got a big stack of episode suggestions and episode ideas. But this one has been on our list for a long time. And I was like, we got to do that one. When the show premiered in 2016, when Trump was in office, it premiered the same year Trump took office. And when that happened, we were all like, wow, the parallels. But now in 2022, it makes the parallels we were looking at then seem insignificant, you know?
Isn't that terrifying?
And, you know, guys, always, obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, this is our 36th or 37th episode at this point. You know where we stand. You know where I stand. You know where Nick stands. You know that we see a lot of hypocrisy on both sides of the aisle, of course. But the right are a bunch of fucking fascists, dude. There's no other thing to it. They're not going to be happy until they're a one-party system, until they're in charge and, you know, everything goes to goddamn evangelical law. Every action they take makes it more and more obvious all the time. And all their obfuscating and all their fucking explaining away of stuff and all of their, oh, it's states' rights and all this nonsense. So it's been scaring me a lot because, you know, they have a chance because I wouldn't say quite half the country, probably more like 40% of the country are like deluded by their idiotic propaganda and believe all the nonsense that the right says. They're like, you know, the Bible says you can't have an abortion. Of course, it doesn't say that or anything like that in the Bible. But their political leaders pretend to be Christians and then say that, and then they all swallow that. So this is going to be a little bit of right-wing bashing on this episode. So buckle in. If you listen to the podcast, you know I bash the left here and there too. They're hypocrites, especially the DNC, the Democrat political party, is a hilarious joke. But at least policy-wise, or at least, you know, their supposed policies are, you know, morally correct. But it's just not the same, man. I can't say it's the same.
You know what, though? I will say this, though, Winston. I think that as far as Margaret Atwood's book went, and I think the problem, what we're really facing right now and what she was really railing against was not like anti-right wing. It was anti-theocracy.
Theocracy is a right-wing idea.
Yes, I agree, like, but there is a part of the Republican Party that these people don't agree with that, because I think I saw that it was like 30% or 70% of Americans want abortion to be legal in some form or another.
As far as voters go, okay, look, let me distinguish here. The way I say, like, the Democrat Party isn't them, you know what I mean? They don't represent that.
Yeah.
And the RNC doesn't represent all right-wing leaning people. I said right-wing earlier. I'm talking about the RNC and evangelicals. So let me be really clear. I misspoke a little earlier. So I'm talking about them specifically. If you're right of center a little bit, don't count the American center as center because it's not. I'm talking about the worldwide center. If you're right of center, that's totally cool, man. We could get along just fine. I have a lot of people in my life that are right of center and we get along just fine. But if you're on the Trump end, the Ted Cruz end, the Rick DeSantis end of it, you're...
Which means you're saying, they're basically saying, I don't give a shit what you think. I don't care about your rights. I don't care about democracy because we're going to overthrow democracy.
The anti-democracy thing is the thing that's really, really scary to me. Really scary to me because it's like...
Me
they
too.
To, and you know, it's evident, like January 6th, we recorded a podcast the day after that a while back. And it was like a literal attempt to overthrow democracy itself. I mean, obviously, the U.S. is not the only elective republic or whatever label you want to apply to it. We're obviously not the only one in the world. But, you know, historically speaking, like the beacon of it. We were the first real democracy in the world. And, you know, we've been like the shining example or the example of that. I don't want to say we were shining because we were often not shining. But it's been an institution for 250 years. And they were trying to just completely ruin that, completely dismantle the Constitution, dismantle civil rights and public rights, make it seem like, or not make it seem, make it so people's votes didn't matter anymore.
Yeah. And that was the goal.
It remains the goal. Okay. But let's talk about the book and then we'll get more back into the comparisons. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So first let's talk about Margaret Atwood. Margaret Atwood is a Canadian novelist, a poet, big time activist, school teacher, tons of essays, children's books, graphic novels. She's a highly productive Canadian author, not necessarily a science fiction author. She doesn't like the term science fiction. She actually rejects the term science fiction when it's applied to her work, especially when it comes to this book. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But she's known for this book. She's known for Cat's Eye. She's known for Oryx and Crake, which we'll probably get to that a little bit here in a little while. And she was born way back in 1939. She is 82 years old. So she would have been 7 years old when World War II ended. So she probably has some vague memories of World War II taking place. If there's anybody around right now who has the standing to speak on authoritarianism, it's Margaret Atwood. She was a kind of an underground writer, kind of looked at as sort of a fringe writer in like the speculative fiction, science fiction community through her early works, which started in the 60s and then through the 70s, even though she had some relatively well-known books. But it wasn't until Handmaid's Tale in 1985 that she really broke through into the mainstream of the genre. Handmaid's Tale was published in 85, and it was the finalist for the Nebula Award, which is the best science fiction or fantasy book of the year, in 1987. And it lost to, this is really crazy to me, that year Orson Scott Card's Speaker for the Dead won.
Uh-huh.
He won the previous year for Ender's Game. And I've read both Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. And then Ender's Game deserves to win, I think. Speak of the, for the Dead definitely does not, especially against The Handmaid's Tale. And it also won against Count Zero by William Gibson, which is a better book than Speaker for the Dead, and Free Live Free by Gene Wolfe, which is a better book, in my opinion, of course. And, you know, I don't know why they decided to give Orson Scott Card two wins in a row, but they did. And they really snubbed Handmaid's Tale, which is, in my opinion, the best book of that lot by a mile. Definitely the most original and unique, and I guess important is the word I would use.
Yeah.
Okay, so 1985, this book comes out. It's released a huge literary acclaim, causes quite a disruption at the time in academia, in politics, because let's be honest, it's a radical book. And okay, so for those of you who don't know about The Handmaid's Tale, about the premise of The Handmaid's Tale, I'm just going to give you a brief synopsis of the story here. So the book is about a character named Offred, which is of Fred. And she is a handmaid, which is a woman who is still able to bear children. Okay, so let me start over. In the not too distant future, a radical right-wing religious theocratic movement assassinates the president of the United States and most members of Congress, and then stages a revolution in America and transforms America into the Republic of Gilead, which is a complete theocracy based on a particular interpretation of Old Testament biblical beliefs. And then restructures all of society in America to have class systems where men are at the top of the class. It's a patriarchal, white supremacist government now, and all white men are at the top. Beneath them are their wives. Beneath them are handmaids who are basically all women. From men down, all women are slaves. They lose all their property rights, their right to vote. They're not allowed to be taught how to read or write. And men are completely in control.
And also there's an infertility crisis going on.
Right. And I'm going to get to that. So while this is happening, there's been at some point during this struggle, it's not made clear in the book, but at some point during this struggle, there was a nuclear fight of some kind. And basically the Midwest of the United States is an irradiated wasteland. And somehow related to that, somehow possibly related to other factors, fertility among women in America has dropped completely. It might have happened before the events of the book. Infertility was on the rise before, and then I think radiation exacerbated that problem. So in the Republic of Gilead, they have very few fertile women. So their solution to this is to make these women who are fertile sex slaves, reproductive slaves. And their job is to serve at the beck and call of their master. They call them commanders. And the commander basically uses them for sex while the commander's wife watches on in this sort of like religiously ordained rape, and with the idea of impregnating the woman to have children that the commander's wife would then raise as their own child. And Offred is the handmaid to a commander. This is her third assignment as a handmaid. And before all of this happened, before Gilead became a place, she lived a normal life as a normal American woman in the 20th century. Was, you know, considerably more liberal than was allowed in Gilead and is allowed in Gilead. The book basically tells this woman's story as she writes in her journal, giving an account of her day-to-day life and the things that happened to her. Over the course of the book, she ends up in a kind of a coerced intellectual slash romantic relationship with the commander outside of the church-appointed rape, because according to these new laws, they're not allowed to have any sort of romantic connection outside of that. But the commander does what he wants, basically brushes that rule aside, courts her, not necessarily, I wouldn't say out of love, but so that he can have a romantic relationship outside of his marriage. And he has Offred come to his study in the middle of the night and play Scrabble with him. And basically, he uses her as like a toy for his mental stimulation, while already using her as a tool for his sexual stimulation. There's a lot more to the story. I don't want to tell you every single thing that happens in the book, but it's a pretty depressing story, I'd say. It was treated as a science fiction story. And Margaret Atwood had a problem with that, because Margaret Atwood was like, listen, science fiction should be defined as stories about things that can't yet happen, that we haven't reached the scientific ability to achieve yet. And she points out that in her story, all of the things that happen in the story can easily happen. and that it fits more in the line with dystopia than it does science fiction, because there is no scientific thing happening in the book that can't happen now. I'm not sure I agree with her definition, and I'll explain that in a little while when I get to...
I don't.
Well, I don't either, and there are two reasons I disagree with that. Everybody has their own definition of science fiction, mm-hmm. and the more I run a science fiction magazine and a science fiction podcast, the more I realize that. The more I realize that the definition is pretty hazy.
Yeah.
You know, what separates speculative fiction from dystopia, from science fiction, from fantasy? There's a lot of gray area to some people. Everybody has their own definitions and kind of eliminates gray area in their own mind. Mm-hmm. So this was written in 1985, and this was at the height of Reagan America. We talk about Reagan America a lot on this podcast because it was a big sea change in the American political system. Before Reagan's America, America had a lot of liberal leanings. You know, there was the hippie thing that happened in the 1960s, and then through the 70s, people were...
How about the New Deal?
Yeah.
The New Deal of the mid-40s.
Yes, exactly.
You know, that really set up the middle class. There was no middle class before then.
Right. And that's been largely eliminated now, thanks to the right.
Reagan.
Yeah, thanks to Ronald Reagan and basically selling all of our interests to corporate overlords. And so now basically corporations run this country, and corporations don't really care for a middle class. It doesn't help them as much because they need poor people to work at their factories in order to build things. And middle-class people don't go work at factories. Middle-class people have desk jobs. So they're continuously working to get rid of that. And they have quite a bit. The wealth gap in this country is at a record disparity right now. I just read this the other day. The wealth gap in America right now is significantly worse than the wealth gap during the French Revolution. When all of the aristocrats were dragged out of their castles and hanged and beheaded.
Yeah, and Winston, if you can chart, you know, I always tell people, listen, if you want to talk about anything to do with policy or implications for society, you have to look at national data and you have to look at national historical data. If you look at the shrinking share of the middle class GDP, which accounts for, you know, that's a measure of the wealth that the middle class owns, it has, since Reagan, drastically dropped. Why? Because of the policies of the Reagan administration attacking the middle class.
Trickle-down economics, which is the biggest load of horseshit that ever got spilled out of anyone's mouth. Like a complete demonstrable lie that could easily be demonstrated to be a lie through over 40 years of data. It has not worked even for a millisecond over 40 years.
And yet it keeps getting passed. The tax cuts that happened just under Trump.
Corporate bailouts. There was a short time during the Clinton administration where some of that middle class regained its power. But once Bush took over, that went away again. And then it hasn't returned since, even when Obama was president.
It always happens under the guise of tax cuts. And what happens is they give a massive tax cut to the wealthy.
And then marginal tax cut.
And they tell people, look, you got a tax cut. And so people save $100 a year.
Right.
But it's like, but what really happened is they cut all of your services.
Right.
So now everything, your education is worse. Your roads are worse.
Yep.
Your infrastructure is worse.
Yep.
Your everything, your insurance has gone up. Your education costs have gone up. So, yeah, it's been just a very systematic. It's actually fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
And I mean, it has worked.
Yeah,
it's brilliant and it has worked.
And the worst, the thing that blows my mind most about it is that the people that still root for this the hardest are often, I mean, obviously the people who root for it the hardest are CEOs. And, you know, billionaires. But next on the list of people who root for it the hardest are people that are dirt poor, who have no money to speak of. We've talked about this before, the temporarily embarrassed millionaires that think that rich people should get a break because they've somehow earned being rich and it isn't the result of economic policy or government policy or corporate welfare. That's the other thing. Is they're all
or inheritance.
Not even to mention generational wealth and much of that generational wealth going all the way back to like slave labor, like Elon Musk, for example. Here's my moment where I'm going to pick on one of the worst human beings I could think of right now. This guy is such a complete clown. Guys, I know he inspires a lot of science fiction type people with his rocket ship stuff or whatever, but you know, fuck this guy. He is such a fake, and hear me now. This dude's a complete fake. And, you know, 20 years from now, when you're listening back to this podcast, you're going to say, well, he was right about that. Bet. whatever. I'm going to get off of him now because I don't want to spend the whole episode berating this guy, but not a fan. Let me just go ahead and tell you that.
Me neither.
Okay. Well,
me neither, man.
Okay. So now we have the rug pulled out from the middle class, and then we have this giant gap growing between the classes, and that is creating a class system, which is the idea. That's the idea. Because once class systems become the norm, it's easier to organize people into allotted classes. Now I want to talk about why Margaret Atwood decided that Handmaid's Tale wasn't science fiction, why she says it's not science fiction. Like she said, that everything in it can happen. None of it is impossible with our current science. And that's true. The other thing is that she says she wrote the book looking at things that were going on in the United States in the 1980s. Like everything that she used as inspiration for this book were things that were happening actively that she could observe from Canada in the United States in American media. And now, coming up on 40 years later, 33 years later, all of that is coming to a head because the totalitarian, authoritarian right wing is making the power grab that she predicted. And they're doing it by relying on those instilled biases. They're going to take away women's rights. They're going to take away body autonomy from women and thereby making them second-class citizens. Some people think, oh, well, that's just the extreme part of the Republican Party that's doing that. And I'm saying, again, I'm saying the political party, not every right-wing person in the country. And there's some people who are like, oh, well, that's just the extreme end of it. It's not. It's not at all. It's not in any way. Look at how they vote. Don't look at what they say in the sound bites. Look at how they vote. Look at how every Supreme Court justice that was installed by a Bush or Donald Trump votes. They vote.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's the issue. Is the issue is the pillars of a democracy are being taken down systematically by what is now a very, very radical Supreme Court.
Yes.
And that has to do with not only reproductive rights, it has to do with voting rights.
Oh, yes.
It has to, you know what I mean? It has to do with campaign finance, eliminating campaign finance. It has to do with clean air and climate change.
Everything.
They are going to go through and destroy every. And now they're appointed for life.
Yep.
They have a 6-3 majority. But Roberts is somewhat in the middle of the road. He's definitely right wing. But those other five are lunatics.
Yeah.
And they've been vetted.
Yes.
I was explaining this to a buddy of mine. I'm like, you have to understand something. That for what happened under Reagan was the evangelicals realized if we're going to take power, because they had appointed a number of justices that were supposedly right wing. And they turned out to be not really
right wing. Not as right wing as they wanted them to be. They ended up being.
As they wanted. Just like Roberts.
Right, yeah, just like Roberts. Yeah.
So what they said was, we are going to create a record of anybody who's appointed as a judge at a state level, at a very small level, small federal level. And we're gonna compile using think tank money, using think tanks and money from billionaires. We are going to compile a report card on every one of these people, okay? And then over this 20 years, we will have we will know exactly what kind of person this
right.
is. And so by the time we get to Bush and then especially to Trump, they knew these people were the most lunatic evangelical right-wing judges that existed.
Right.
And what did Trump say? He said it in public. I'm just going to appoint whoever the Federalist Society tells me to appoint.
Yep. Yes, 100%.
And guess what?
And
now we have lunatics.
Okay, so here's the thing. Okay, so the opinion was written by Alito, and that's the one that leaked. And a lot of people think they're Supreme Court justices. They're really knowledgeable of the law. They'll write their arguments based on law. And if none of you have read the leaked opinion, let me just say this. There's nothing law about it. His arguments are that historically speaking, and when I say historically speaking, he goes back to the 1600s and quotes pastors who literally accuse people of witchcraft as his examples to write this opinion. And that's how far he has to go back. And because that historically speaking, women didn't have these rights then, that it is now judicial precedent to keep that law alive today. So his basic argument, and anybody can call me out if you think I'm wrong about this, but I've read it. His basic argument is that because people in the 1600s didn't give women rights, that there's no legal basis to give them rights now. And that these kind of rights, the rights to privacy and these kinds of things since, you know, that time are in error. They were done in error. They were created, you know, not in accordance with legal standards, which is obviously a bunch of bullshit. He might as well have said, well, in the Bible, it's this way. So why would we change that?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. And that's what Margaret Atwood was saying. It's the end of logic.
And so here's the thing. Some people are like, well, I don't personally like abortion. So it's kind of a 50-50 toss-up issue in some people's minds. I strongly disagree with that. In my opinion, in my personal opinion, no man should be allowed to vote on this issue at all. Because it literally, we never have any part of it. You know what I mean? Once we have sex, we don't have to deal with it again. Sometimes for the rest of our lives.
We don't have to carry the baby. We don't have to give birth. We don't have to even if.
Yeah. And
it's the whole thing is fucking
And you can be
insane.
Sued. You can.
It's just insane.
You can be sued. Of course, you can be sued for child support. And people are. But I guarantee you that'll be the next thing that goes is child support. But I don't want to get into speculation here. Because there's plenty of actual things.
Yeah, there's enough real.
There's enough real to easily. Okay, so people are like, okay, that's just, this is a kind of a middle of the ground issue. But, you know, abortion is a problem to some people. You know, they think it's child being murdered. That's obviously scientific nonsense, but whatever. And here, okay, look, I'm just going to go ahead and say it for the record. You can't be a human being until you're able to think. And that's full stop. Like, I think, therefore I am. Until you're able to process thoughts and have awareness, you're not a person. And there's nothing in the world you're going to say that's going to change my mind. Because if you call a zygote a person, you might as well call a sperm a person.
Yeah.
Because it's the same.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really good point. But isn't that what goes next?
Yeah.
Doesn't contraception go
but
next?
That's what I was about to get to. That's exactly about to get to. Some of these states, okay, and they're like, this should be a state's right issue. And some of these states, Louisiana, for example, is trying to ban contraception. I think it's Arizona is trying to ban condoms, for Christ's sake. So this is not about this is not about saving babies at all.
No.
There's nothing about saving babies
here. It's about theocracy.
This is about theocracy.
It's about theocracy.
And you know, the thing is that the people who are in charge of this, who are trying to get this implemented, who want the theocracy, most of them aren't Christians in like any sort of real sense. Donald Trump, I've said this a million times already on this podcast. If you can send me a photo of Donald Trump attending a church service before he was running for president, I'll send you $1,000 because such a photo doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Donald Trump doesn't give a fuck about the Bible, not in any way.
Hell
no. He just knows, he's smart enough to know that it's a great tool for control. If he says, this is what the Bible wants you to do.
Absolutely.
Then, you know, people who are Christians who believe in all the things in the Bible, which you can't believe in all the things in the Bible because they contradict each other so much. But if you believe that you believe all the things in the Bible, you're going to say, well, now I'm scared of going to hell. So I better do what this guy says because, you know, I don't want to go to hell. Like, and, you know, I've got to be a good Christian. Even when it's painfully obvious that the person you telling you that is a complete hypocrite. Even when the televangelist gets caught blowing a trans guy in a parking lot or whatever it is, whatever thing, whatever hypocritical thing they do. Not that you can do whatever you want in a parking lot. Let me make that clear. I'm not judging you. I'm just saying, don't say that's an evil thing and then literally be doing it that night. Don't try to tell people they're going to hell for doing it. Then that's what you do in your spare time. That's what's wrong with the world. So, okay, now we've got right now the Republican Party, and it really is literally the Republican Party doing this. And it's, you know, there's a lot of both side-isms to this topic. You know, like I said, the Democrats are literally just sitting on their hands most of the time and not doing anything, even when they're like, they have the presidency and control of the House and a slight majority in the Senate. Mostly they're just sitting on their hands. They are not doing anything proactive to prevent this slow crawl.
And if you think about it, it's really, I think that is the biggest problem. And it could be the end of America, the end of democracy. And the reason is because religious fanaticism will drive a person to strap a bomb.
Oh, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
It will absolutely, it absolutely will get someone so motivated and focused in their life. And unfortunately, the majority of us who aren't like that don't have that.
Yeah.
And so you have this 20-30%. I think that's what Margaret Atwood was really, really trying to point out, was that, listen, the minorities of fanatics can take over so easily because they're so fucking passionate.
Yeah.
They're willing, like in The Handmaid's Tale, to assassinate, you know, members of Congress and fuck, just like July 6th, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, January 6th.
And you'll never get it.
Like, what happened with the insurrection?
And I see so many people now trying to be like, oh, that's not what was happening. It was a guided tour. And I'm like, man, how delusional can you be? You have to watch like a 2-minute edited clip of what happened that day and literally avoid watching anything else about it to believe that. I mean, they had goddamn gallows pulled out in front of the place. Come on, man.
I know. It's crazy. I know.
You're right to say that it's religious fanaticism. And, you know, driving people to religious fanaticism, it's a fairly easy thing to do. And historically speaking.
Yes.
Yes, historically speaking. I mean, there were the Crusades. There were the Inquisition. There were the Salem witch trials.
How about QAnon?
Don't even get me started.
Right? I mean, people are uncertain. They're confused. They're scared. The middle class is vanishing. They know it's vanishing. And they're like, I need answers. I can't deal with this uncertainty. So now the new religion is fucking QAnon.
Yeah, and exactly. You know?
It's just
another structure for understanding.
I'm going to give you answers, you know, that are illogical.
What's really funny about QAnon is that they answer questions that aren't even being asked. They're like, oh yeah, dude, do you know why children are being eaten? It's because of, you know, and you're like, dude, what children? Are they being eaten? Who said anything about that?
In that vein, I will give a little plug. You got to watch the new Mike Myers Pentaverate.
Oh, man. I watched an episode. My wife and I watched an episode of it. And, you know, if you're a Mike Myers fan, it's very Mike Myers, man. He plays like 7 characters.
It's like so
there are 5 members of the Pentaverate. He plays 4 of them.
Yeah, but what's so great about it is that it's so, like, so ridiculous. But he is making fucking fun of QAnon to a T. Like, you're like, oh my gosh, it's so fucking awesome. Anyways, back to what we were saying.
Okay, so basically in the novel, in Handmaid's Tale, this way of thinking becomes so prominent and sown throughout the society in America that it eventually takes over and America is run that way in a fascistic, authoritarian theocracy. And Margaret Atwood says in her mind that this is the road we're on. This is our trajectory. So unless something happens to stop it, this is where we're going to end up. And as of 2022, we're still on that road, you know, and there's not very much done to stop it. And not only are...
You know what's crazy about that, Winston, is don't you think it's accelerating?
Oh, it's of course accelerating. Of course it's accelerating. And, you know, the Republican Party is attempting to accelerate it every single way they can. Every single way they can, by calling their opponents pedophiles. You know, it's a classic fascist move to say, oh, Disney's pedophiles because they, you know, here's what happened. Disney said, we're going to change our policy at Disney World so that instead of saying boys and girls, we're going to say hello, everyone, or hello, children. And that was the actual policy change. That was what really happened. And because of that small bit of, you know, I'm going to use their term, wokeness, the line from the Republican Party was, wow, Disney is groomers. They're grooming your children so that they can have sex with them because they didn't say boys and girls anymore. They just said children because of identity rights. And that's fascism. That is fascism. Saying my enemy is an inhuman monster because he's doing something that we oppose. That is fascism. And that's the beginning. Meanwhile, you know, they're like, make sure you have open carry, you have constitutional carry. Everybody in our party should be allowed to have an AR-15. And no matter how many actual children are being murdered, as we're recording this, the Texas elementary school shooting took place just a few days ago. And the racially motivated shooting in Buffalo took place like a week before that. And you can add up the gun violence very easily, very easily. And these are people that are radicalized. These are radicalized people, not all of them.
Winston, I think that kid who did that school shooting bought those AR freaking guns legally.
He did buy them legally because Texas makes it extremely easy to buy a gun.
And there's a new Supreme Court case that's coming up. They're going to go after New York's law.
Of course.
So it's like democracy is over.
It's getting there.
It doesn't matter. It's over in the sense I was telling my buddy, you know, he was like, well, you know, maybe Democrats can get the House back in the, you know, if we lose that and there and we can get the, you know, whatever. And if we lose any part of that, I'm like, it doesn't matter
yeah.
what is passed. These laws are already on the books and they're being nullified.
Yep.
They're either being completely nullified or they're just taking out the ability to prosecute or whatever it is.
Right.
And so it's terrifying, man.
So, okay. Now we're kind of getting near the end of this episode, I'd say. And so now I'll talk about two things at once. One, the same thing is why I think that The Handmaid's Tale is a science fiction novel, despite what the author says, and why that there is some hope. Okay, in the book, the Republic of Gilead takes place, and Offred apparently, she takes all these notes. And at the end, there's an ambiguous ending where you don't know what quite happens to Offred, but then there's like an epilogue that takes place 150 years later. And in this epilogue, they're examining tapes that somebody made of Offred's diaries and using them to study the Republic of Gilead in retrospect. So the message there is that scientific reason eventually came back around and won again. And that the period of theocracy and religious fanaticism was only a stage in the development of humankind. So I say that that makes this a science fiction story because there is a whole future society in the story that's actually part of the story. And to me, when that's in a story, that automatically groups it into a science fiction story. That's just me though. I know, everybody has their own interpretations, but it also provides a lot of hope. Even if we do fall into this madness, and make no mistake, this is madness. There's no reason to any of this. This is just a power grab by a handful of assholes. If you're for this life, you will live to regret it. I guarantee you. Unless you're one of those people who's allotted power. Because trust me, when there's religious law and there's no like fair democracy, they can drag you out behind a building and shoot you in the head for whatever reason they want to. Doesn't matter if you're a white guy, doesn't matter if you're a gun owner, doesn't matter if you're a Christian. None of that matters. If they don't like you, they'll just murder you. Because that's what fascism is.
They could separate families and put kids in cages.
Yes, exactly. And they will. And they have and will continue to do so.
You know, the thing that just is very, I think for me, is so discouraging about it is that I've been involved in climate change since I was in college. And it's been a long time. And we are nearing the point that was, you know, we were warned about 40 years ago, and it's only getting worse. And it's getting worse very fast. And the Supreme Court is going to do anything they can to gut. Not only can we not pass anything in Congress with a Democratic majority because of Manchin, but even if we did pass something, do you think the Supreme Court is not going to gut it?
Of course. Of course they will.
And they'll do that for the next 40 years, and we don't have 40 years.
And, you know, at a time in history like ours, that could be the end of humanity.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
But supposing that it doesn't end humanity altogether, and it just creates a period of, like, another Dark Ages, which is kind of like what the book implies, then, you know, the next people that come along will be people that will want to tackle the problem head on. That would be the next stage. Yeah. So, you know, obviously that.
And I agree with you. That does make it sci-fi. Without it, it's so Logan's Run for them to be examining tapes and, you know what I mean?
So I live in Colorado and the wildfires here get worse every year. Climate change deniers are like, there's been wildfires since forever. It's like, yeah, but they're measurably worse every year. It's measurably hotter here every year. It's measurably drier here every single year. That's not how nature works.
There's no more water for the West Coast.
You know what I mean? That's not how nature works.
There's no more water for the West Coast. You're talking about 70 million people in California, you know? There's no water.
Like ultra conservatives are like, good, you know, good. I'm glad. I want all them Californians to die.
It's not just them though. There's no water for Arizona. There's no water for New Mexico. There's no water for, you know, for Nevada, there's no...
Let me just make it clear. I don't care how ultra-conservative you are. I still don't want you to die. I'm not wishing any harm on you at all. I just want you to change your mind. I want you to wake up and realize what's actually going on and stop being led around the nose by superstition. That's what I want. You know what I mean? I don't want you to die at all. I need your help. We need your help, you know? And you're like an anchor right now, and we want you to be a sail with the rest of us. But, you know, you can't convince people to go against their superstitions, man. It's really hard.
Yeah, I know. This really does remind me of works in Craig Hearn, Margaret Atwood's next book. So if anybody's really interested, it kind of takes over from, you know, where the dystopia, you know, like we're talking about how depressing it is. And it takes over like after society fails.
And she refuses to call this book a science fiction book as well. And I'm like, this book has every hallmark of a science fiction book that I could think of.
Yeah, you're on crack.
Well, I was like, what are you talking about? This is definitely a science fiction. It has like, not only does it have all the speculative fiction elements that I already group into science fiction, but it's got like genetic engineering and all sorts of crazy other things like that.
Yeah, and genetic engineered like a whole society of people.
Yeah, like a whole being. So it's like weird. Bioengineering is a big, basically, bioengineering is basically the main topic of the book. So in case you guys haven't read this one came out in 2003. We're just going to talk about it real briefly because we're getting near the end of the episode here. This is basically her climate change book. And this is about corporations developing bioengineering technology and then one gigantic jerk off creating a plague, intentionally creating a plague that kills a bunch of people. But even still, it's too late. Climate change is already kind of underway. Even though this pandemic this guy creates kills like a ton of people in the world, it doesn't matter. It's still too late. There's still already all this heating up world and everything. Both of these books that we mentioned just here and other books by her as well really show you how these topics, these really important topics to humanity, these dangerous, scary topics, like the rise of theocracy, totalitarianism, or climate change, or the dangers of genetic engineering, or super plagues, about how best they are addressed through speculative fiction and science fiction writing.
Yeah.
And like, it goes back to like why we do a sci-fi podcast, you know, it's because when we want to talk about the important things, the best way to talk about them, in my opinion, and in lots of opinions of all these authors and all the people that read them, are through these explorations of what the future could hold if we continue on these different paths.
Yeah, and I think science fiction, it's important. I think one of the reasons that we love it is that, and so many of our listeners love it too, is that it really is a mirror of today.
Yes.
Right? I mean, all the Star Trek episodes, yes, they're really talking about, you know, the issues that Roddenberry saw in, yes, society at that time.
Yes.
And I think that's why Handmaid's Tale created such an impact,
yes,
because people, it resonated and it caused discussion in society in which this rising theocracy was just starting,
right?
You know, and just starting to sink its like tentacles into the rest of society, you know, and that's why it's such an important book then. And now it's an important book because we're going, oh shit, she was right.
Yeah, she was right.
Then they were saying, will she be right? Now we're going, oh my God. Oh my God.
Well, now we're here. But how long will it last? You know what I mean? And that's like the only question left now is when will we be able to escape from it? You know? So, okay, well, this is a depressing episode.
With the Supreme Court? Yeah. Supreme Court justices are appointed for life.
Well,
so, you know.
Yeah, and then even if one of them dies, it doesn't matter unless there's a non-Republican president.
And a Democratic, right, Senate, because remember McConnell, yeah, even though he wouldn't allow the hearings to even take, right, place, it was insane.
It still is insane.
It is, and it's only going to get more insane.
This is a super depressing episode. Sorry, guys. And I know, like, so often get the comment, like, keep politics out of sci-fi. And we've talked about this a million times. And when people comment that.
We tried.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. I just have to laugh at that. There's no way. First of all, politics are part of every part of life. But science fiction, as we've said so many times, it is political inherently. It is political. If you're trying to keep politics out of sci-fi, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything doesn't have to be super serious. It's okay to have fun. It's okay to have fun and use science fiction as escapism. But pretending like it's not political is, you're just deluding yourself. So,
yeah.
All right.
Well, on a happier note, I want to tell everybody right now that I am reading a book called The Candy House,
okay,
by Jennifer Egan. And it is a follow-up to, it's like 20 years in the future. She wrote a book in, it won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. It's called Visit from the Goon Squad.
Right, right.
And it was a great book. I really loved it. But the new one is like 20, 30 years in the future. And it's some of the characters. And Dude, it is so sci-fi. It's called The Candy House.
Okay.
And it is completely effing sci-fi. It is
gonna have
so
to add it to
awesome.
The super long list. Jennifer Egan, the Candy House.
Yeah. If anybody's read it, hit DM me. I want to hear about what you think because I'm loving
on my list right now. I just listened to the audiobook. I'm almost finished. I've got like 30 minutes left. I listened to it on my recent travels. It is Ready Player Two, which talk about a
oh, how is it?
You know, I have to think about it a little bit. It kind of feels, in a lot of ways, it's a rehashing of the first book, but it does have some important, some importance to it too. I'll say I didn't like it as much as the first one. The first one is definitely more of a popcorn experience. And the second one is, you know, in both ways, it's telling on big corporations in both books. And, you know, so it's definitely applicable. Like it definitely is like, hey, don't let giant corporations run the world or this is what happens. You know, that theme runs through in a way into this book too. And then there are other good themes in this one too, but I'm not going to say it's bad or anything. It's okay, but I'm not going to like shout it from the rooftops as a recommendation.
Gotcha.
And then I'm also reading Philip K. Dick's Eye in the Sky, which is very funny. It's so related to this. And it's literally about this group of people fall into a parallel reality where one person's outrageous religious views rule the reality around them, where all the natural law is now based on this one old man's crazy religion. And it's definitely like a Abrahamic Judeo-Christian Muslim style religion. And it's like reasonable people trying to exist in this reality.
Oh, wow.
So it kind of applies a lot of this way too. And I'm only about halfway through it now, but it's excellent. It's one of my favorite books of his I've read so far.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Well, let's, we're back on
a regular schedule now. So schedule. We'll do it again next week. How about that?
Yes.
Okay. We'll think of something.
Next week will be awesome. And I can't wait to watch Obi-Wan.
Hey, yeah, that'd be a good one. Hey man, this one's a little far out there, but how would you feel about doing Futurama?
Oh, I love Futurama.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if not that one, we could think of another one too, but I'd like to do an episode on that one. Cause most everything we do is kind of serious, but it'd be kind of fun to do kind of something silly and fun.
Of course. Dude, people are just going to, they just want to hear us. So yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's great. No, I dig that. Let's do it.
Cool.
No.
All right, man.
We can do it next week if you want.
Yeah, totally. I'm prepared. I've watched every episode like 10 times. So
that's awesome.
All right, man. Well, this is a good one. Glad you're settled in Italy and we're back on a regular schedule. And everyone who listened, thanks for listening as always. And we'll see you again next time.
Adios. Later, brother.
Guys, if you're enjoying the Infinite Worlds podcast, you could definitely check out more Infinite Worlds related stuff by visiting our website, infiniteworldsmagazine.com. There you can subscribe to Infinite Worlds magazine. It's a full-color, ad-free science fiction magazine featuring stories, comics, and illustrations from creators all over the world. You could also sign up to our mailing list. You can follow us on Instagram at Infinite Worlds Magazine or on Twitter at IW Sci-Fi Mag. Also, you can find Nick the Tooth on Instagram at Nick the Tooth and follow his wild escapades. Theme song was written by Christopher Whitaker, and our podcast is produced by Andrew Alonso.